used to impersonate Justin Wilson pretty good, but I seem to have lost the knack. So I won't try that. But I am known for opening with a joke. Is that all right, Charlie?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't start the recorder yet, Greg.
All right, mic's right in front of you.
Okay, thank you. There we go.
There you go.
So let's keep this off the record, Greg. So there's three guys sitting in an American bar. One's from Scotland, one's from England, one's from Ireland, and they're sitting there talking about how friendly the people are. They're drinking buddies back in the home country, and the Scottish fellow says, "Aye," he says, "back in Glasgow, Scotland, there's a bar where the people are so friendly." He said, "After three drinks, the fourth drink is always on the house." And the Englishman said, "Oh," he said, "well, I'll tell you, there's a pub in London, England." He said, "The people are so friendly, after every two drinks, the third drink is on the house." He said, "Oh." And well, the Irishman says, "Well," he says, "all right, oh." He says, "I'll tell you, there's a place in Dublin." He said, "Well, the people are so friendly." He said, "You walk in and they just give you free drinks all night long." They said, "No, not really." He said, "Yeah, Dublin." He said, "And when you're good and soused, they take you upstairs and put you in a private room and make sure you're getting laid all night long." They said, "There ain't no such a place." And he said, "Yeah, Dublin." They said, "That happened to you personally?" He said, "Well, that didn't happen to me personally, but it happens to me sister every time she goes there." Sober, there was a guy that I knew. He was going to some kind of a little some kind of man's retreat, weekend retreat. And he was always talking to me about going. And I said, "What do y'all do?" He said, "Well, we go out there and we try to get in touch with our female half." And I said, "Well, if I got in touch with my female half, I'll tell you what I'd do with it." Was not interested, you know what I mean? And then I met Charlie, and he's always telling me, "You need to come up here to man-to-man." "No, thank you, Charlie." "You need to come to man-to-man." "No, thank you." And one day he said, "Dave, it's man-to-man, not man-on-man." So I cautiously came with him that first year, and I'm standing at the registration desk, and I'm saying, "What's this dot on this on my little tag?" And they said, "Oh, you haven't heard about the dance." And the dresses, and my eyes getting real squeamish. So I was primed for that one before I got here. Anyway, it was a real honor to me when Mike called me and asked me if I'd want to speak here today, because you guys are special and this conference is special. This is my ninth year here, and I could think of no place I would feel more honored to be asked to speak than at the Man to Man Conference. So thank all of you, Tim and Mike, and all of you that were involved with fighting that out. So I'm blind David, and I'm an alcoholic, you guys. I got sober in July of 98. And I can tell you that as a kid, I started losing my sight. And so by the end of the third grade, I could not even read large print anymore. So they sent me to Austin to go to the blind school. And then when I hit puberty, I became a rather hard kid to handle. So by the end of junior high, they kicked me out of there. And I went back to Houston to try to figure my way through a public school as the only blind kid there. But I got in with a real good group of people, and my drinking career got started there. I didn't have much of a chance living in a boarding school, but, boy, I made up for lost time when I got out of there. And I entered high school in 65, and I got quickly into a social circle of people that we were drinking and partying hard every weekend. And I graduated in 68. Of course, you know, the 60s, you know what was going on. There was a lot of other stuff you could try out, too, if you wanted to try some of that. And I did. Tried probably all of it. Got pretty strung out on some of it. But I read where Bill said, then the doctor came and began to administer heavy sedatives. He said the next day found me doing both gin and sedatives. And he said, this combination soon landed me on the rocks. So I don't know if it was the combination or what, but I was, by the age of 24, in my social circle of friends. I'm 5 years out of high school, 24 years old. I've got 7 friends dead. And I could feel it closing in on me. I was burning to the ground. The only thing I knew to do is what the big book says, just blot it out and go on to the bitter end. That's all I knew how to do. But by the age of 24, I crawled into a church desperately looking for God. And I found God there and had a very powerful spiritual experience, which relieved me from that obsession momentarily. And for the next 25 years, I went through the grueling, hard lessons of learning the sober side of alcoholism until I came into AA at the age of 50. 25 years of the hard lessons of the sober side of alcoholism. The big book says to tell you in a general way what I was like, and if I was going to sum it up, I'd tell you that I felt like that I was trapped between an oven and a freezer. And I would start drinking, and it would start getting hot. It would start getting hot, and then I'm starting to sizzle, and now I'm banging. There's only one door in the middle, and I'm banging on that door, begging them to please let me out of here. I want over there. And they go, you don't want over here. We're all dying over here because it's so cold. It's freezing. Oh, you don't want over here. And I say, I do want over there. Let me out. And they let me in, and, you know, and as usual, you step in the freezer, and you go, oh, oh, God, relief. This feels so good. Man, what are y'all griping about? This is wonderful. And that's the way it felt at first. Until you begin to notice how cold it was. Until you begin to notice how painfully cold it was. Until you're banging on the door and saying, let me out of here. And they say, you don't want over here. It's an oven. You'll cook over here. And I say, I do want over there. I'm dying in this freezer. And they'd open the door and let you back in. And you go, oh, oh, relief. This feels so good. Pop a top. Back with the old buddies. God, I can't believe I ever left y'all. Felt good for a while. Until you start to notice the heat. And my life was trapped between the oven and the freezer. And I can remember how many times I'd be drinking. I'd go, crap, I'm drinking again. And then I'd finally get stopped. And after a while, I'd go, crap, I'm not drinking again. Well, what else is there? I mean, you're either drinking or not drinking. I needed another option, and I couldn't conceive of what there might would be. I didn't know. The big book says, Bill talked about when Ebby come to visit him, and Bill struggled with the spiritual kind of idea for a moment, and Ebby said, why don't you just choose your own conception of God, Bill? And he said, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, and a new world came into view. A new world. That's what I want to talk about a little bit. A new world. Bill Wilson said it grows incredibly more wonderful as time passes. It can. And that's pretty neat because all I knew was I drank until it grew incredibly more miserable as time passed. And then I got sober and it grew incredibly more miserable as time passed. And I found another option that grows incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And it's neither the life of drinking nor the life of not drinking. It's totally something else. The big book says we've found much of heaven. And we were rocketed into another dimension of existence that we did not dream existed. It says we have entered the world of the Spirit. There's your other option. It's not the world of drinking. It's not the world of not drinking. It's the world of the Spirit. And the big book says if you are an alcoholic, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So you read in that chapter, if you're struggling a little bit with this spiritual idea, you know, like Bill did, it talks in chapter 4 to the agnostics about this. And it kind of illustrates, it talks about the Wright brothers and them, their mainspring that led to their first machine that would fly, you know, and it says, yet we have been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation. from this world. People who rose above their problems. They said, God made this happen. And we only smiled. That's what Bill did when Abby said, I got religion. And Bill said, oh, God, last summer an alcoholic crackpot. Now he's a little cracked about religion. Yeah, he's got that story. I'd look all right. So what happened to me? Well, I came to believe, because I'd already done the spiritual thing, remember? I went into church. I had a very powerful spiritual experience. What did I have to come to believe? I came to believe that there was a God in AA who worked in a very unique way for alcoholics, through alcoholics. And it says we made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And you'll notice there on page 60, it says, what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? It did not say, sort of what do we mean by that? And sort of what do we do? It says, just what do we mean by that? Just exactly what do we do? And it says, well, first of all, let me explain to you what it ain't. And it says, most of us try to live by self-propulsion. And it's fixing to describe the sober side of alcoholism. I start being driven by self-propulsion. I start wanting to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, all the rest of the players. I want to become the most famous preacher in town. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core of my being, and I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And the longer I live that, the more voices I got in my head trying to help me figure it all out and how to cut corners and work the angles and come out ahead, come out on top. I become preoccupied with life. It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. I didn't know that's what I was doing. Yeah. I'm wrapped up in my head to where I can't even hardly go to sleep at night, trying to figure out my next move. I had to quit playing God. It doesn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter, in the drama of life, isn't it funny how quickly it turns into drama? Next, we must learn in this drama of life that God will become my director. And I want you to notice it says, this is the how and why of it. If you don't have that underlined, you should underline it, because what does that mean? This is the bottom line, boy. If you hadn't heard anything up till now, listen. This is the how and why of it. First of all, you got to quit living life in your head. And all the drama, where most of it's in my head. And next, I've got to work these steps and open a channel through my heart to another voice. And start learning to live a little bit out of my heart. And it didn't say sorta. It said just exactly what we mean by that. When we sincerely, for God to become my director is the how and why of this program. I must not forget that. That's it. For God to become my director. I think it's interesting. Over on page 87, somebody was talking about it last night, where it says we pause. And that sounds so simple. Pause and agitated out philosopher. I've tried that prayer thing, it don't work. Well, that's because you hadn't worked the other 85 pages to get there to where it will. And you know, when the big book says many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them. If another code of morals or better philosophy of life was sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. And then the big book gives us another code of living and a better philosophy of life. But it also gives me the power to live it. And the better code of living is not how to work angles on life. It's how to stay in connection with God, to be my director, to keep me out of my freaking head. And I have to learn to recognize when it's ramping up in my head to get out of there. And that's where I spend my time with God, to stay in touch with that other voice and kind of keep God on tap. The better job I stay in touch with God, the more instantly He responds when I am in a crisis. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. Now notice, when God leads, remarkable things follow. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. Wow, that's the first thing I tell my sponsees to do. Circle the word if. God does this. If you do this, what does God do? Everything else you need. What do I do? Keep close to Him and perform His work well. There's one and in that statement, not two. It didn't say, if I keep close to Him and perform His work well, and. People say to me, they say, Dave, you don't understand. I got issues outside the scope of this program. I said, let's read it again. He is all powerful. What's outside the scope of that? He will provide what you need, what was left out. There are no other ends. If I keep close to Him and perform His work well, and it says established on this footing. And I always try to make sure that my sponsees understand. I say, that means I'm supposed to make sure that when you come up to me and start talking to me about this, I'm going to jerk you right back here and say, let's read it again. I want you to be established on this footing. I don't want your foot to slip off of this. This is a contractual agreement with God. He will do this if you will do this. Do you get it? Good. Then established on such a footing that there is nothing else. God responds to nothing else, but you do that. Someone told me, I don't like that God over in church. He's mean. I said, He's mean over here too. He said, here's the deal. I do this, when you do this, the ball is in your court. And you can cry and you can cry and you can beg all you want to. But until you do exactly what it is, nothing happens. But you will be amazed what will happen if you do. Established on such a footing, we felt new power flow in. Well, we became less and less interested in ourselves. I'm not obsessed with working all the angles on life to try to stay ahead and make ends meet. I still tend to life, but I'm not preoccupied with it. We became less and less interested in ourselves. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence. We began to lose our fear today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. As I worked through the steps, all that unfolded. Well, why do I have to do step 4 and 5? Why do I have to do step 8 and 9? I don't know. Do you want remarkable things to follow? Do you want to enter into the world of the Spirit? There's a price to pay. Do you want to become more and more conscious of His presence and lose your fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter? I do. The suffering of being sober. Good God, please set me free. Free me from all the fear voices in my head. And help me find that God voice that's in my heart, so that He can become my director through all the drama. You know, Bill said in the 12 and 12, all of AA's 12 steps are to deflate our egos. They go against our natural desires. They're to deflate our egos. Did you know, as I deflate my ego through that process, and by the way, it also says in the 12 and 12 that to obtain greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. So the principle behind step 1 is humility. And the principle behind step 2 is more humility. And the principle behind step 3 is more humility. In case anybody wants to know. I don't know where that other set came from. And so as I deflate my ego through the process, it's letting God in. if I ever want to start inflating my ego, it just starts pushing God back out. And you know, right after steps four and five, you know, the dreaded steps and admitting to God, it says that by that time I have achieved enough ego deflation to begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. I thought I had felt that many times in my past. I've had powerful spiritual experiences in church. I don't discredit my experience there, unless you're an alcoholic. And you got to put a different twist on it. Step eight and nine, if you do it, you will achieve enough ego deflation through steps eight and nine that about halfway through, it says, you read these promises about halfway through, and one of them is you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. The voice of intuition. God's becoming my director. That part of the program, remember the how and why of the program? It's beginning to seep into my experience about halfway through step nine, to where I'm beginning to get to know this other voice. I don't only feel his nearness, I'm beginning to discern what it's trying to tell me. But you got to pay the price to get there. I remember they had a guy come to meet one time. He was new, and they gave him How It Works. You want to read How It Works? And he's going, yeah, and he's reading along. And here's steps we took, blah, blah. He's reading along, and he got down to made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. He said, Jesus Christ! He said, have y'all read this? So at that point, I'm starting to be deep enough into humility to be surprised that when I pause and ask for the right thought or action, God, what was that? That was called a new voice, a new sense of direction. Without it, an alcoholic doesn't stand a chance. And after step nine, it says, now we have entered into the world of the Spirit. Whoa. I remember reading that because I thought I had done that before, you know, and I read, you've entered the world of the Spirit. And I thought, I wonder what that means. Well, I was far enough along in my program. I'd done my morning prayers and little thing, and I was going to an 8:30 morning meeting. And I remember saying, God, I think maybe I'm ready to help somebody or something. And I just kind of asked God, maybe in my near future I could work with somebody. I went to that meeting. I shared a little bit. And when I'm walking out of the meeting, this guy caught me and he said, hey, Dave, I liked what you shared, man. He said, I wonder if I could get your phone number. I said, sure. Wow, that was cool. That was quick, you know. And so I gave him my phone number, and I went home. Now, I was going to take a nap that day. Now, my wife had told me that her sister was coming over to bring some homemade egg rolls. Her sister used to be one of my little connections for pain pills, because I used to have a bad back until I got into AA. And she didn't know I was in AA yet, and I don't see her that often. But anyway, Norma told me she was coming by, and so I thought, okay, well, I went home, and I laid down and started to go to sleep, and I hear this knock on the door, and I thought, oh, yeah, I forgot about Becky. So I went and opened the door. She came in. We went in the kitchen. I opened the refrigerator. She said, here you go. And I held out my hand, and she gave me a pan of homemade egg rolls, which I put in the refrigerator. She said, here's something else. And I did this, and she put a pot in my hand. It was like rice and stuff to go with them egg rolls. And I thought, cool. And I set it in there. She said, here's something else. And I went like this, and she poured a whole pile of Vicodin in my hand. I ain't sober very long. And my heart is going in my throat. And Becky she talks a lot. And that day she talked forever. God, I want her to leave. And she said, that ought to hold you a while. And I'm thinking, I can swallow these in one go. I'm good at this. It was six of the big ones. You know, I can do one gulp of those. Sorry, y'all. But let's get back on track. But anyway, so she left. And now I'm running back to the kitchen to get the water jug. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. I ain't supposed to do this. So now I'm walking around the living room fighting with my hand. Don't do it. Yes. No. Yeah, but, and, you know, oh, God, it's the torture. God. And I finally thought, okay, put them in the drawer. Go take your nap. I'll put them in the drawer. I laid down. You can't go to sleep when something's screaming at you from the drawer. So I got back up, and I got them out of the drawer, and I'm going back to get the water jug, and Norma came home. So I'm, you know, And... And she went in the back room to change clothes, and I thought, go tell Norma, go tell Norma. You know, she's got a lot more sobriety than I do. And so I'm running down the hall to go tell her, and poof, my old friend popped up. And he went, hold on, let's talk this over. And I am being ripped in half by the struggle of yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And just like I used to do, I want to say, I ain't going to think about it. I'm going to swallow him, and then we'll talk. So I'm running back down the hall now to go to the end of the kitchen to get my water jug. My phone sits right by the kitchen door, my old landline. If I had been one step past it when it rang, I would not have turned around to go back. I would have said, hey, Norma, can you get the phone? You know, the extension in the other room. If I'd have been one step before it to where I'd have had time to think, I'd have said, hey, Norma, get the phone, because I'm on my way to get the water jug. I was exactly split second. My foot hit the ground right back, and it went bring, and I didn't think at all. I just grabbed it and said, hello? And this guy from that morning said, Dave, I'm about to drink, man. He said, talk me out of it. And I talked me and him out of it. My sanity returned. I couldn't believe how quick that agony of yes, no, yes, no, yes, no went away. I could not believe that that phone rang at that split second. I'd already forgotten that guy. And I said, so that's what they mean by you have entered the world of the Spirit. People, this thing is real. If you've done them other steps to get here, this ain't church. This is a power greater than myself that does for me what I can't do for myself. What I'm like now, I continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along, because what brought me into the world of the Spirit is what's going to keep me here, and I am diligent about that. That's all. It's pretty simple. So I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and when they crop up, I ask God at once to remove them, discuss them with someone immediately, and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, and then I resolutely turn my thoughts to helping another alcoholic. And life just kind of goes on in the background. It doesn't demand my full attention. I take that, and we discuss it with someone immediately. I take that very literal. You know, there's times when I do something, and I hope nobody finds out, oh God, and I have to go tell on me. Not everybody, but at least one person, I've got to tell on myself. There's times I have to make me tell on myself. Then there's times when some people have kind of come out against me, and all of a sudden I'm wanting a whole posse to come out and go back against them, and I'm telling everybody what they did, and I'm getting everybody on my side. And it says, no, you may go talk to your sponsor, one person. I take that literal. When it says, just what do we mean by that, and just what do? We take that pretty literal, don't we, Charlie? Mm-hmm. And it tells me that there's a time when I have to make me go tell one person. And there's a time when I have to make me only tell one person. And that eliminates talking about it in the meeting. When you know better. You're okay until you know better. But now you know better. I heard a guy in a meeting one time. I had a particular behavior that I'd promised my sponsor that I was committed. I would tell him every time I did it. That's the only way I was going to stop this. But I'm sitting in a meeting one time, and I hear this dude say, I got me an alternate sponsor because my main guy's out of town a lot. And I thought, hey, that's cool. Because mine's out of town a lot, too. And so I asked this guy to be my backup sponsor. He said, cool. Well, all of a sudden, I did that behavior. I hadn't done it in a long time, so I didn't mind calling my sponsor and having to tell on myself. But I turned right around within about 3 days and did it again. I don't want to call him and tell him I've already done it again. And I thought, I know, I'll go call the other guy. When we say alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, it wants to make me cheat on my step work, on my commitment to our program. I want you to know it took me a week and a half to get the courage to call my sponsor and tell him I did that again. Now, happy to announce that about a year later, I did that behavior twice back to back real close, and it only took me 3 days to find the courage. So... So when it says we ask God at once, we discuss it with someone immediately, we make amends quickly, the project of step 10 is to become a little more at once, a little more immediately, and a little more quickly. And it says if we have carefully followed these directions, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we become God conscious. We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense. Remember what the how and the why of this program is? It's that. And step 11 says we're going to learn now to improve our conscious contact with God. Step 10 is all about maintaining it. Step 11 is about improving it. And it's going to make some suggestions. It says this is about prayer and meditation. It'd be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And it's going to make two wonderful suggestions on how to do meditation. I've been to every meditation workshop I can think of since I've been in AA. Haven't heard anybody yet come out of the big book and teach meditation. Shame on me too. So it's going to make some definite and valuable suggestions. At page 86, paragraph 1, here's your first meditation. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. I don't mean a quick... scant inventory. I'm talking about a meditation. Were we resentful? Selfish? Dishonest? Afraid? If I have begun to develop a conscious contact with God, and if I'll take a breath between each one of those, if God needs to talk to me about one of them, I'll feel it. And when I feel it, I pause and say, what? And then I say, and what do you want me to do about it? The most important thing in my life is that. That is the most important part of the program, is that I learn to do my inventory as a meditation. People say, I do mine about once a month. Well, great. Twice a month would be better. Once a week would be better yet. Twice a week would still be better. Try to get it down, it says, when we retire at night. Now, I can tell you that I probably do it 29 out of 30. How free do you want to be? So remember, when I told you about that, established on this footing, you'll slip off of this footing in step 11 if you don't understand that keeping close to Him and performing His work well, and there ain't nothing else. And every step after step 3 has to pertain to one of those two things, because there ain't nothing else. All the steps are about either inventory to keep close to Him or performing His work well about service, because there ain't nothing else. And my first meditation is keeping close to Him and improving that. My second meditation is the next paragraph. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours a day, the 24 hours ahead. I do that. I wake up going, what day is it? What do I got to do? Before I begin, what does that mean? That means before I put my hand to the plow and start working on the day, I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking and set aside my self-seeking motives and to bring my thinking into His employ. Didn't it say back in step 3 that I have a new employer? Oh, well, my real job is this. So it's time for me to take a little time in the morning to bring my thinking into His employ. And what is my job? To carry this message to that. What message? This one, right here in the book. Oh. Well, I guess I better sit down here with my cup of coffee and open my big book and learn what meditative reading is. When I learn to bring the conscious contact with God into my morning reading, particularly if I've done my inventory last night, God is in my morning reading, and He's teaching me and giving me insights into that book that will rock your world. I quickly had to start taking notes. And I never will forget the experience when I thought, you know, I'm going to start forgetting some of this stuff. People say, that was good what you shared, Dave. And I go, yeah. And one day I thought, I'm going to start forgetting all these little gold nuggets. I better start writing them down. And I remember the morning I went and got my stuff to write. And when I sat down, I almost felt God say, oh, you're going to take notes? Well, then get ready. And if I keep close to him, I will learn how to perform his work well. The reason I keep close to him through my inventory is to perform his work well. The first thing we learned in that sponsorship workshop yesterday is how intuitive it always is. You're learning that every time you're working with somebody, you're saying stuff that you never heard before. And you're taking notes. I still take notes when I'm working with somebody. It's a very intuitive thing. And if I leave out the intuitive contact with God, alcoholics are hopeless. They're hopeless for us to help. Unless I stay connected to God through meditative reading and writing. And so he is all powerful and will provide what I need if I will keep close to him and perform his work well. And I get people after that third step, I say, now if you really got what I'm saying here, then you understand that you don't have nothing left to worry about. You need to worry about this, not other stuff. I remember the first time I started doing that step 11 inventory, and I guess I hadn't got my own message yet, because I got down to the end of that inventory and it says, were you careful not to drift into worry? I thought, well, no, I worried some today. Of course I worry. I mean, you can't not worry. You can't live life and not worry. Everybody's got to worry. Life don't run itself. What do you mean don't worry? I said, that's a dumb question. You don't have the right to ask me that. I'm going to just chop off my inventory right here. That's the end of that. And the next night I come down there, did you worry today? Of course I worried today. What a dumb question. I mean, I don't understand how you even have that on here. You don't have the right to ask me not to worry. And the third night I did the same thing. Did you worry today? Yes, I worried today. Good Lord, who don't worry? You can't not worry. You don't have the right to ask me not to worry. And I felt God just grab me and jerk me up and say, I do have the right to ask you not to worry. And you stop doing it. And I want you to know I felt that. That was one of the strongest things I felt since that phone call. Well, I was thinking, oh, I see what you mean by the world of the Spirit. Suddenly I'm talking back to God, and I feel God grab me by the shirt and say, you listen to what I'm saying, and you stop doing it. I had to sit there for a while and say, well, why do you have the right to ask me not to worry? And I had to go back to my third step agreement and go, oh, yeah. But this is like a three-tiered fountain, y'all. The water comes out up here at the top of this little thing, and there's a little bowl. It's called my evening meditation, review, and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. That's the point at which I maintain humility enough to stay connected. And if I do that, that little bowl will fill up and spill over into this next bowl. It's called my morning meditation. It's a bigger bowl. I can't even contain it all unless I start taking notes and writing down. And God, you can't wait to get to the meeting to share the stuff. And when that bowl's full, it spills over into this big bowl down here that's called the rest of my life. And if I want God in the rest of my life, he comes from up here to here to here. And that's those three paragraphs on page 86. And all I got to do to stop the whole process is reach up here at the top, put my finger on the top of that little pipe, and cut off my evening meditation, and it would all dry up. And then the next thing you know, I'll be just reading, and I'll be just going to meetings, and I'll just be living life again. I know I'm running out of time, aren't I? Oh, good. Okay, good. I got two more little things I want to say. So just to give you an example, I went to a group conscience at this particular group that really, they had started something at that group that was screwing up the group really bad. And so I made a proposal that we stop that. And I made another suggestion. And when I went to the group conscience that morning, it was packed. I've never seen so many people at a group conscience. They were not there to support me. They were there to vote down my proposal. It was first on the agenda. It was overwhelmingly voted down. And then they all left. But they all got up to speak against my proposal. And, you know, Properly, you're supposed to get up and tell why you don't support the proposal. One guy got up and started talking about the idiot that made the proposal. You're not supposed to do that. And I'm sitting there going, I'm a bigger man than he. I'm not going to let that bother me. I can let it roll off my shoulders. God, it don't matter. That was on a Saturday. But I want you to know that somewhere around Sunday, I had a bright idea how I was going to get even with him. I decided on the next group conference, I was going to stand up first and say, now before we, I said, some of y'all have come out today to vote for things and vote against things, and you're going to come to the microphone and you're going to express why you don't support this. And I said, but don't be such an, I'm on tape, aren't I? Don't be such an a jerk that you get up here and talk about the person who made the proposal, because that's sorry. I was going to kind of let everybody know what a dog he was for doing that. I thought what a nice indirect way to get even with this guy. So I'm doing my inventory that night. Were you selfish? Were you resentful today? And the little ding bell went off. Because you'd take a little breath between each one. Give God time to respond. And I felt the response. And I said, what? And he said, this little plan you've got to get even with John. I said, I thought that came from wisdom. I thought that was you. I thought that's the way you would want me to do this. And he said, no, that's your resentment talking to you. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, people. It's only meditation inventory where you can sometimes split hairs between the voice of God and that subtle voice of the cunning, baffling alcoholism that wants to try to inch me away from God and then lasso me with a drink. I said, I thought that was you. He said, no, that's your resentment talking to you. I said, well, then what would you like me to do? He said, I want you to invite him to your Christmas party. I had very carefully not given him an invitation. And I said, God, why do you always have to take it to the next level? He said, I'm trying to take you to the next level, Dave. Do you want to go? I do. So I'm going to tell you this one last story. I had a son. He was a hard, it was rough. He found drugs and alcohol when he was 13. His mom's an alcoholic, and I'm an alcoholic. His mom's dead from alcoholism, and I was almost dead at one point in my life. he started at 13, and I lost him. No control of that kid. And it was a hell ride. It helped me a lot when I got into recovery to learn tough love, which we have to do. And after many, many hard years, he finally got sober. I was so happy. And I remember, I play a harp. Some of y'all may have heard me, I don't know, but I take Bible scriptures and put it to music. And when I got in AA, I started taking a big book and putting it to music. It's pretty cool. Got some pretty neat songs. But I remember back in the day when he'd come over just wasted out of his gourd. He'd come over with two or three friends and say, I want y'all to hear my dad play his harp. And he'd sit them in the living room and let me sing scripture on a harp to them. There was something about him that was trying to reach out to that. And he had a high respect for my spiritual life. And he finally got sober after all them times. And he was about 2.5 years sober one day. Came over telling me about how well things were going, and his wife and his new baby that was about 1.5 years old, and his business was going well. And so he was starting to leave, and my wife leaned over and said, tell your son you're proud of him. And I just grabbed him. I said, I'm proud of you, son. I'm glad I did, because he drove off into a head-on accident. It was the next morning. Got hit with a truck. And My wife came home from work because I was sleeping by day. She goes to work during the day, but she came home. She woke me up. She said, "Dave, wake up." And I said, "What's the matter?" I thought something's wrong. You know, you come back home from work. She said, "Something's happened, Dave." And I thought, "Yeah, I guess it has. You've probably wrecked the car." She said, "Brace yourself, Dave. It's really bad." And I thought, "You totaled the car." She said, "Caesar was in an accident, Dave." I said, "How bad is he?" She said, "He's dead." And it was felt someone shot me up with ice water. I just, all my insides just chilled. But I did what I've been practicing. I reached over and hit the pause button on that VCR. You know, the drama, all the, "Oh God, what do you do now?" And I just reached over and hit the pause button and grabbed hold of my heart and went with that. I said, "Where's Sarah and the baby?" "They're at the hospital." I said, "How are they?" "They're hysterical. Her family's all there. They're hysterical. Everybody's hysterical." And I got dressed and got to the hospital. The baby's crying. I got the baby. I got down on the floor and played with the baby. Got the baby laughing. I got up and prayed with the mom and dad. Prayed with Sarah. Took her down to see the, and say goodbye to the body. Then I went. It was a long day. I had to go to the funeral home and make arrangements. And it was an exhausting day. But everybody was riding on my coattail. You're a source of strength at times like this, if you're connected. I went to my aim, you know, I got home, and Nora said, "I'm going to go lay down and rest." And I thought, "Well, I'm going to go pray." And I kneeled down to pray, and I felt something. I'm feeling something. It was a little not pleasant. It was kind of, it was a little agitated. It was an unpleasant feel. And I thought, "Okay, God, what are you trying to tell me? I'm feeling something." And all of a sudden, I realized what I was feeling was Caesar. I've gone to visit him in jail before, you know, where you talk through the glass, and he's banging on the glass, saying, "Get me out of here, get me out of here." You know how it is when your son, and they, "Please bail me out, come up with the money, go get all your friends together, you know, get me out of jail." And it felt just like that. It felt like that he was suddenly clang, the wall, the doors closed. We all have a date with that death, you know. And you don't come back through that door. And he was trying to get a message back through that door. And when I knelt down to pray, I felt him. And I said, "Okay, Caesar, I feel you, I feel you, I feel you." "What?" And he began to tell me the things he wanted me to say to the people that were important. His wife and his baby. To say his goodbyes. I said, "Okay, I got that." He said, "And tell Norma." Because he hadn't finished his amends yet. He wanted me to tell Norma that he's sorry that he hadn't regained her trust and respect fully like he wanted. And he wanted me to go tell his wife's parents some things along the same line, that he's sorry that he never had time to fully regain their respect. I said all that at his funeral. But the greatest thing that ever happened in my life up till this time was when I got through saying, "I got you, Caesar, I hear you, I got it, I got it." I didn't hear any words, y'all. The voice of the Spirit has no words. And if you don't practice, you don't learn how to discern what it's saying. And I practice discerning what it's saying when he says, "Know that's your resentment talking to you. I want you to invite him to your Christmas party." That's where you learn, is in inventory. And I, so I got all that message through that veil. And I said, "Okay, I got it." And then all of that relaxed, all that stress. And he said, "Okay, then I can go now." And he said, "Thanks, Dad. I knew you'd be the one to hear me." The greatest thing ever said to me by my son came through the veil. As he said, "I knew you would hear me." But I went through a journey for the next month of spiritual experience after spiritual experience. I first went to a meeting that night, walked in a few minutes late. I sat down and said, "What's the topic?" I didn't say, "Guess what happened to me today?" I said, "What's the topic?" And I talked on topic. Now, I had friends in my life that was aware of what's going on that I could talk to privately, but I didn't go in and take the meeting hostage. And so I talked on topic, you know, and I would cry now and then. Usually every night while I'd sit there, I might have a five-minute cry. But then, you know, you kind of shake your head. Because it would come in that meditation. And I didn't feel, when you're connected to the Spirit, it ain't all lost and gone. It's still there. And one night, I was sitting there wondering, because they said he hung upside down in the car for 45 minutes till they could cut him out and fly him to fly. And I often wondered, I wonder if he was suffering. They said, oh, no, he was very unconscious. And I was thinking, I wonder if he, but I just wondered, it tormented me to wonder if he was suffering, hanging upside down in that car for 45 minutes. And I'm sitting there in my meditation, wondering that. And God came in and said, would you like to do a retroactive prayer for your son? I never heard of a retroactive prayer. I'm sure it doesn't fit church theology. I don't know. Just like when Brooks said a voice told him to go get a dog. And he said, no professional person told me nothing like that. I don't know where this came from, except God said, would you like to make a retroactive prayer? I said, yes, I would. I said, I want to pray that, and this means to go back to that moment. I said, I want to pray that after that accident, that Caesar did not suffer hanging upside down. And when he took his last breath, that you had an angel waiting to escort him into your presence. And I felt God take that prayer and go. Oh, my Lord lightened a whole lot right there, y'all. And, you know, I told my wife one night, she went over to clean out his house, and the ex, you know, the wife and all that. Caesar used to write some poems while he was in prison. And Norma found a box of them. She was thumbing through some of them to find some that she thought she'd like to keep. She found one she thought I'd like to keep. And so that night I'm sitting there kind of sad, and I'm saying, you know, because of my religious faith, I said, I wished I'd have heard Caesar make that profession of faith just one last time. You know, about the Lord, you know, that's my thing. And I said, I wish I could have just heard that one last time. And Norma said, oh, well, this poem's for you. And she pulled out a poem and read me Caesar's poem about all that and about his Savior. And I grabbed that poem and I said, God, I've got it right here in print. And, you know, just that whole month long, little thing after little thing, one night I picked up my harp just to try to comfort myself. And a lot of the songs I get from God come pretty quickly. It's like, and they're nearly all right behind some life event. And I picked up that harp and started playing, and God gave me a new song that was so beautiful. I sang it every night for a month. And every time I did, Caesar came into that room and danced around the room as we praised God together. Little by little by little. I come down to the end of that month. Now, and I'll finish with this. And I keep a gratitude list. A vital part of my nightly review is my gratitude list. It's ongoing. And I don't want to miss thanking God for things he deserved to be thanked for. You can overlook that if you're not careful. And my average monthly pages on my gratitude list was about 8 pages. There was a really good Christmas month one year that I wrote 12 pages. That was my record for a month in my gratitude list, was 12 pages. And I'm getting down close to the end of September, and I happened to lay a page over on that stack, and I noticed, good Lord, that stack's tall. Now, keep in mind, this is supposed to be the worst month of my life. The worst month of my life. But I stayed on program, did my stuff, and I noticed that stack getting kind of tall. And I started thinking, God has done an awful lot for me this month. Just to step in and take the slack out of all that. And I wasn't even at the end of September yet, and I'm already at 24 pages of gratitude. 3 times my average and double my previous record. In the worst month of my life, God gave me more things to be ecstatically happy and grateful for just to carry me through that time. I went into a meeting one time to share this, and this girl sat there and she said, I relapsed this weekend because my mother died last week. I said, my son died at the first of this month, and I shared this story about my gratitude list. I said, God, I'm glad I didn't take a drink and miss all that. Two people came up and asked me to be their sponsor after that meeting. The big book says when so many people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their life. Oh, the how and why of my program is to be connected to another voice that takes all this away from me, or at least helps me to get it loose from it. To pause and reach out for God in Him to be there. It ain't no good if He ain't there. Oh, but He's there. If I know just what it means by that and just what to do. The consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of my life. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs, because the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of my life. Thank you all a lot.